From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. What do we think about when we think about thinking? You know those occasional reflexive moments when for a split second, you get this weird sense that you're standing outside your mind, looking in? Well, today we'll take a closer look at how we think. We'll talk about the worst kind of mental manipulation.
It's like raping the mind, almost.
We'll meet a philosophy professor who argues that America today is the most philosophical culture in the history of the world.
When I was on a book tour for the hardcover edition last year, I had a lot of people in audiences say to me, "Are you crazy?"
And a neurophilosopher on the life of the mind.
There is no difference between the me that I am and the brain that I have.
We'll also investigate a new way of thinking about misunderstood artists, the advanced genius theory. But first, the guy who taught us that thinking isn't all in the mind, psychologist Daniel Goleman, the man behind the phrase emotional intelligence. Steve Paulson recently interviewed him, and Steve, remind us, who's Daniel Goleman?
Well, and he's a clinical psychologist who worked for many years as a science writer for the New York Times. But what really put him on the map was his book, Emotional Intelligence, which has sold millions of copies since it was first published nearly 20 years ago. And this book has had a profound impact on the way we think about intelligence. It showed us that IQ is arguably less important than our people skills, our ability to get along with other people. And now a lot of business leaders are taking up the banner of emotional intelligence. But that is only one piece of what makes Dan Goleman interesting.
Yeah, isn't he also one of the Western scientists who's gotten really close to the Dalai Lama?
He is. Goleman was one of the first American scholars to go to India to meet the Dalai Lama. So he helped make Buddhism respectable for Americans, not only as a meditative practice, but also as a science of the mind, which has challenged some fundamental ideas about Western psychology. And there's a fascinating personal story as well. Back in the 70s, when Goleman was doing his doctoral work at Harvard, he met Richard Alpert, who had been fired from Harvard because of his infamous LSD research he'd done with Timothy Leary. Alpert later went to India, became a spiritual teacher. Well, Goleman heard about a fellowship to go to study in India, inspired in part by what Richard Alpert had done.
He had gone to India and come back not as Richard Alpert, but as Ram Dass, and was talking about yoga, which then was very exotic, meditation, which was practically unheard of, although it was starting to be part of the zeitgeist, and a transformation of being that sounded very interesting to me from a psychological point of view. So I grabbed that fellowship, ran off to India, met his teacher and many others, including a wonderful man named Kunu Rinpoche, who I later learned was the Dalai Lama's instructor on compassion. You can imagine what he was like. And I realized that there was a psychological system at the heart of Buddhism that was absolutely unknown in Western psychology. And I started to write about it and about the way it worked with the mind, the way it conceived of what you could do to transform the mind, and meditation was very much at the heart of that.
What didn't Western psychology understand about this?
Western psychology did not understand, A, that practices like meditation did transform the mind, and now we know the brain. No one had ever heard of the word neuroplasticity in the 1970s, but the idea that repeated experiences change the structure and function of the brain was implicit in Buddhist psychology and unknown in Western psychology. And also the fact that you could transform the mind to the point where, for example, your inner emotional state was not at the whim of external conditions, but was an ongoing, say, equanimous state that was one of kindness. This was inconceivable.
You're saying psychologists in the 1970s didn't even think about this kind of thing?
I would say psychologies in the 2010s don't think about it that much as a whole, although it's getting to be a more and more familiar idea, yes.
So to pick up the story of your own journey, so you were a doctoral student, getting your PhD at
That's
Harvard.
Right. That's right.
Then you discovered all the stuff about Buddhism.
Well, what I discovered was an alternate psychological system. It's called Abhidharma, which is the Sanskrit term for this model of mind. And I started writing about it in psychology journals, albeit very obscure psychology journals, because they were the only ones that were interested. I felt that it was important to bring this news to Western psychology, because what it did was extend the horizon line of the potential of being human. You know, if psychology is about anything, it's about the mind and what are its upper limits, what are the worst places we can go, what are the best places we can go. And this describes some best places that we hadn't heard of yet. They weren't on the itinerary.
Now, you are probably best known for your book, Emotional Intelligence, which has gone on to sell millions of copies. How did you get interested in this subject?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and that's really someone who works with emotions all the time, although I did go into journalism. So I was covering what they call the decade of the brain in the mid-90s, and the National Institute of Health had given a lot of money to brain research. And very interesting findings were coming out, and I'm covering this. And in the Times, you can write, in those days, you could write an article up to 2,000 words. Now it's, I think, 800, which is a story in itself, yeah. But another story. I realized that there was a bigger story here, and that I really wanted to write a book about the new science of emotion in the brain. That this was very new and exciting, had lots of implications for our everyday lives. And I happened to, since my job was basically to harvest academic writing, I would read technical journals and then translate them for everybody in the Times. I stumbled across an article that had the title Emotional Intelligence. And I thought, wow, that is a powerful concept. Sounds like an oxymoron, but it means we can be intelligent about emotions. It's written by a guy, a friend of mine, Peter Salovey, who's now the president of Yale University. He was a psychologist at Yale then, and his, I think, a graduate student, John Mayer. And I took that concept and used it as a frame for a book on emotions writ large.
So what's the difference between emotional intelligence and the more classic way we talk about intelligence as measured by IQ?
Well, IQ, which is, of course, extraordinarily important, is academic intelligence. It's verbal abilities, it's math abilities, it's spatial reasoning. It's the kind of smarts that helps you get through school and do very, very well. But it turns out that once you get into the workplace, that kind of intelligence predicts powerfully what job you can hold. You need an IQ of one standard deviation or so above average, 115 to 120, say, to be a professional, to be a doctor, to be a nurse, to be a teacher, to be a top executive. But once you're in those roles, IQ isn't a powerful predictor anymore of who will be successful within that discipline or at the top ranks of a company. Turns out that how you handle yourself and how you handle your relationships is a more powerful predictor of who, for example, will emerge as a leader. And that defines emotional intelligence, how we manage ourselves, our self-awareness, our empathy, our ability to collaborate and negotiate and so on.
So this is about being good with other people.
Being good with other people is part of it. Being good with yourself is another part. Being able to get done what you have to do, to have fun, to be spontaneous, to be focused. All of that has to do with self-discipline, but that's part of emotional intelligence too.
Now, you said that emotional intelligence is key to good leadership. Is that widely acknowledged among, I don't know, corporations, the business world, the academic world, that top leaders should have a high degree of emotional intelligence?
It is more and more, and I'm rather surprised. When I wrote the book Emotional Intelligence, I had one thin chapter called Managing with Heart. And on the basis of that, I went on to write another book, which was Working with Emotional Intelligence, about workplace benefits of being emotionally intelligent and for leadership. And the Harvard Business Review asked me to write an article on emotional intelligence and leadership called What Makes a Leader. That was in 98. It is still one of their most requested reprints. And that's because companies and organizations are buying it in bulk to pass out to people.
What are the essential qualities to a great leader?
I would say from an emotional intelligence point of view, the essential qualities of a great leader have to do with self-awareness and using that as a, for example, an ethical rudder. Is what we're doing or what where we're going in keeping with our sense of purpose, values, meaning, our mission? You can't know that without self-awareness. I would say that managing yourself well is absolutely essential for a leader.
What do you mean, managing yourself?
Well, emotions are very unruly. However, there's a set of emotions that help people work at their best. And leaders have a privileged position and a tough position emotionally in an organization. And it's this. In any human group, people pay most attention to and put most importance on what the most powerful person in that group says and does. That makes the leader the emotional sender. And there's a series of experiments that have been done, mostly at the Yale School of Management, where people in a working group, a leader, is put in a bad mood and then goes into the group, and everyone in the group catches the mood and performance goes down. Hmm. The leader's put into a good mood, people catch the good mood, performance goes up. So there's an optimal internal state for performance. It's called flow sometimes. There's whole literature on that. And it has to do with feeling good, being energized, being enthused, being motivated, and people work at their best. Well, you could say, once you understand that, then the leader's emotional role becomes helping other people get and stay in their best state. Well, you can't do that unless your own emotions are under control. You've got to come into work in that state, or you've got to radiate it out in some way, implicitly, not in a clunky way, like, hey, don't we feel great here?
You're really talking about the capacity to inspire and what goes into that.
Yeah, and inspire in the root sense of the word, to breathe in, to... There's a brain-to-brain bridge. Social neuroscience has discovered this, where emotions become highly contagious. And they, as I said, they tend to flow from the most powerful person outward. So you're inspiring by your being.
Daniel Goleman is a psychologist and science journalist. Spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of Goleman's ideas about emotional intelligence? We're always curious to know what you think. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter or post a message on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, why the United States might be the most philosophical culture in the world, ever. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Does it seem to you that America is becoming more shallow and vacuous with every passing year? Do you think we've devolved into a culture of reality TV and brainless celebrity tweets? Well, take heart. Philosopher Carlin Romano believes that America is actually a deeply philosophical nation. Romano's the author of America, the Philosophical, and Jim Fleming talks with him.
In the introduction to your book, you argue that America in the 21st century towers as the most philosophical culture in the history of the world, an unprecedented marketplace of truth and argument that far surpasses ancient Greece, Cartesian France, 19th century Germany, or any other place one can name over the past three millennia. It's a pretty bold statement to make. I imagine in the world of philosophy, to use the vernacular, them's fighting words, ain't they?
They are. They're meant to be a bit of a stick in the eye to the intelligentsia that is always claiming the opposite. When I was on a book tour for the hardcover edition last year, I had a lot of people in audiences say to me, are you crazy? Are you just trying to be obnoxious and so on? And one of my stock responses would be, well, what's your candidate? Ancient Greece, with that enormous diversity it had of slaves and people from 11 different places in the world. Cartesian France, where people are operating in French and Latin and don't know anything about other cultures. The more you zero in on the reality of America today, how many writers we have, how many books we publish, how much freedom of expression we have, begins to make more sense to people. So I'd say within philosophy, it seems like a crazy notion. But I must say that I've learned a lot since I published my book, and it's only been in support of the thesis. I'm astonished to learn since the book was published how powerful standard academic American philosophy has become around the world.
So many of us find the notion of philosophy difficult to approach due to its academic nature, but you've stretched it, not just Hugh Hefner, but at one point in the book, Robert Fulghum, the author of All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. He is not a man that most people would identify immediately as a philosopher, and yet you've included him.
Right. I should note that when I did that, I did it with a chapter title called The Casual Wise Men. So I'm trying to distinguish people like Fulghum a bit from hardcore academic scholars. But Fulghum is actually an example of how surprising people can be. People often aren't who you think. Fulghum turned out to be someone who had studied Wittgenstein very closely, Gandhi very closely. He is a serious intellectual who was trying to then break down his ideas into simple forms. So you probably remember some years ago when George Bush said that Jesus was his favorite philosopher, lots of people mocked him. And yet, there are many people who think of Jesus in the academic world as a philosopher. One more example. Today, the media endlessly trumpets tweets as an important form of discourse. Well, you know, people who write in simple one-liners, what we used to call aphorisms, like Fulghum, are they that different than tweeters? I mean, either a sentence can be serious and invite serious thought, or it can't. I think most of the culture believes it can.
One of the other things that you do in America the Philosophical is to look at the whole field, and there's a chapter, a section, really, called The Rising Outsiders, and you talk about African Americans in philosophy, but it's a very small percentage of at least the academic world, isn't it?
Oh, it's worse in philosophy than almost any discipline. In fact, I think it is the worst of all the humanistic disciplines in regard to diversity. Women, if I'm remembering right, are now maybe low 20% of the faculty. African Americans are closer to 1, 2, 3%. I remember I quoted a friend of mine, wonderful person, Lucius Outlaw, who now teaches at Vanderbilt, who came from a typically working class family in Alabama, became a philosopher. When he encountered all of this epistemology and linguistic analysis stuff, he said to me, I didn't come out of Alabama to parse sentences. You know, he cared about social action. He cared about political philosophy.
You've also opened up the history of it a little bit. It doesn't change the percentages much, but you do look back and find that there is more there than we thought. There's the African-American philosopher Alan Locke, for instance. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, he's a pretty fascinating figure. Still undiscovered, you might say, by the tradition. One reason was that he had primarily aesthetic interests. He's most famous in American culture for being kind of the spark plug of the Harlem Renaissance. He was very helpful. He edited The New Negro, which was a very important anthology for the Harlem Renaissance. He was also gay at a time that it wasn't easy to be gay in academe.
We're talking about the early part of the 20th century here.
That's right. He eventually became the chair of the philosophy department at Howard University, and so he mentored a lot of young black writers and thinkers. And another oddity about Alan Locke was that he was a Baha'i, a religion that still, I would guess, you know, fewer than 1% could tell you what it is. So he had all of these eccentric interests. I'd like America the Philosophical to be a book in which people discover figures they never met before and in a concrete way that makes them interested.
Your last chapter, I guess you'd call it an epilogue in the book, is Obama, Philosopher in Chief. We've talked about how important it is for the discussion to be of events as they are. Is that why you say he's the philosopher in chief?
Of course, I was grateful to the country for reelecting him because my book would have been remaindered immediately if Romney were president. I'm glad that chapter still is somewhat contemporary. Seriously, I think he is a serious intellectual. I ride on some other books that are quite excellent, such as Reading Obama, which go back in Obama's intellectual career. You know, he read Niebuhr. He argued with the Brazilian philosopher Roberto Unger at Harvard. He's a serious guy who's done serious reading and will probably write serious books after he leaves the White House. I tried to focus on his speeches, many of which I think he is deeply involved in his crafting of them after he gets it from the speechwriter. And I believe we do have a line of American presidents who have been serious intellectuals like Jefferson or Wilson, and that he's in that line. So, you know, I wasn't claiming he's Immanuel Kant, but he is somebody who I think often deliberates perhaps too much. When he's getting knocked about for Syria now, I think it's probably because he thinks too much about all the ramifications, not too little.
So philosophy does play a part in the way he conducts himself as commander-in-chief.
I absolutely think so. I mean, I think if any of us could get inside Obama's mind and understand the way he has thought through perhaps intervention in Syria, the moral aspects, the legal aspects, you know, the obligation to save lives and all of that, we would be stunned by how philosophical an internal deliberation that was. It's not for mocking.
Do you think that changing the way we think about America, changing the way perhaps we think of it as America the philosophical, changes the way we face issues, the way we think of ourselves as a part of the world?
I would hope so. George Packer has a new book out, The Unwinding, which kind of, you know, argues and got a lot of positive attention that the country's falling apart. And I think that's crazy. I don't think the country's falling apart. One of the reviewers mentioned that he said, you know, Tampa was a living hell. Tampa? Have you been in Aleppo? We need to have a broader view of where we stand in the world. And one of the things I was trying to do with the book was to indicate that we are a powerful culture intellectually. We should not be shy about that. I didn't mean to be jingoistic, but I did think that we should be confident about what we do intellectually.
Carlin Romano is a philosopher and critic at large of the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's the author of America the Philosophical. He spoke with Jim Fleming. Do you ever have the feeling that someone is messing with your mind, you know, playing games with you or deliberately confusing you? Well, there's a name for that, but we can't say it on the air. Philosopher Colin McGinn wrote an entire book about it, but we can't say the title on the air either. I can tell you it rhymes with mind trucking and that the subtitle is A Critique of Mental Manipulation. So, Colin, how do we talk about this? Is there a radio-friendly euphemism you like to use?
I used to call it MF.
Okay, MF, that
MF,
works.
Yeah, okay. MFing, MF.
Okay, we'll try that. What exactly is an MF?
MF is a type of action that somebody performs on another person where they try to interfere with that person's mind, make them do things against their own best interests or against their own best reason in such a way as to cause emotional upheaval.
There are a bunch of different variations on this, though. I mean, that makes it sound very negative, but you begin the book by describing at least a few ways in which MFing can be sort of pleasurable, like classic movies like The Matrix or Fight Club have a kind of mind-blowing twist ending.
Exactly, yes. So there's the positive and negative species of the MF. I think that the negative kinds are the more dominant ones and they're more interesting ones. But at the same time, there do seem to be cases where people speak of being MF'd by a film that they liked very much. It means one in which their expectations were led in a certain direction and they firmly believed that certain things were going on in the film. And then suddenly, like in The Usual Suspects, something happens that upsets all those expectations. And they find it thrilling as a kind of frisson of surprise. And sometimes it can be quite extreme where a person suddenly reverses everything that they've thought before. So there are the positive kinds of MF. I talk about them in the course of the book. Even philosophy I describe as a little bit of MF going on in that, because it can lead to these, in this case, pleasurable or intellectually stimulating upheavals of thought. And most people enjoy that. It's possible, of course, to find those things distressing at the same time. Many people find skepticism distressing, but many don't.
So is this why you got interested in this subject from a philosophical standpoint?
Yes, very much from a philosophical standpoint. In fact, a specific reason was I gave a lecture in New York many years ago now about the mind-body problem, and I was proposing a certain kind of view which was found by many people to be rather revolutionary and surprising. And somebody afterwards said to me, that was a real MF, and I'd never actually heard the phrase before, and I instantly knew what it meant.
It's a dubious compliment.
I knew what was in the lecture. I could see what they had in mind, and I thought, what a strange phrase, and it lingered around, knocked around in my mind for a while, and then for some reason one day I thought, it may be good to think about this phrase and try to spell out what's behind it. So that's how I got interested in it.
It is a strange and kind of interesting phrase, but I'm curious why you find it philosophically interesting.
Well, it's philosophically interesting in somewhat the same way that BS is interesting. You're trying to say what's involved in, say, Harry Frankfurt was interested in what's involved in the difference between lying and BSing. Lying is a case where a person intentionally gets another person to believe a falsehood by making that person think that you, the speaker, believes the thing that you're lying about. So BS, if you had just looked at it without much analysis, you'd think it was much the same thing, but actually it's different. And so Frankfurt pointed out that really the BSer is somebody who is indifferent to the truth, just uses the truth or uses the false either way in order to get whatever he wants to do, which usually is to create a good impression. So the idea of the MF is similar in that respect. It involves the idea of falsity. So I use the example of Shakespeare's Othello, where Iago is convincing Othello of many false things about his wife, Desdemona. So you might think, oh, is MFing then just a type of lying? But no, it's a little bit more interesting than that, because it involves particularly the idea of disturbing somebody's emotions and then maybe even driving them into a kind of breakdown, which happens with Othello.
Yeah, when I think of the word MF, the term, I tend to think it means somebody's playing mind games with you. You know, that expression, somebody's messing with your head in a way that is deliberately manipulative or deliberately deceptive. There's something a little sinister about it.
Exactly. These are rough synonyms, aren't they, of the MF? Playing with one's head, messing with somebody's mind, and so on. The MF, though, is a much more emphatic phrase, a sort of pungent phrase that captures, I think, some of the sort of the immorality of the negative MF. You know, playing with somebody's head, it sounds like a kind of a nice thing to do. But if you're thinking of very despicable propaganda about something, you know, trying to stereotype a race or something of that sort, like Nazi propaganda, then, of course, to say that you're playing with people's heads seems very much an understatement.
So there's something aggressive about it.
Aggressive about it, exactly. It's aggressive, it's directed to the mind. It's like raping the mind, almost. It's manipulation, but even that is a relatively weak word. Mm. Assaulting the mind in some way. That's really, I think, what the word MF tries to bring out, the strong character of this kind of manipulation.
What's the first historical case you can think of involving MFing?
Well, as I say in my book, you can take it back to the Plato and the Sophists, where really the idea of sophistry is very like the idea of the MF. And in the case of Plato and the Sophists were people who rented out their skills in convincing people of various things. If you were on trial for something or something of that sort, you would hire one of these Sophists and they would come in to defend you. And they could use any means whatever. So they would manipulate the jury. They would appeal to prejudices. They would use fallacies. They would use any trick in the book in order to win the case. It's not much the same now with law. The idea of going by the truth and not manipulating the jury. You know, no lawyer does that. They do whatever they can. So Plato found that rather deplorable. And he wanted to advocate strict reason. In other words, you only persuade people of things by appealing to logic, evidence, and so forth. So he was opposed to the Sophists, and I think ever since Plato there's been that division within Western civilization between the Platonists, the believers in reason, and the Sophists, who are more like politicians or lawyers, who use any emotional means, push any buttons, play with any minds, whatever phrase we use, in order to achieve a certain end. In other words, they don't really care about the truth, and success for them is a matter of just of winning.
No, it's the concept of spin.
It's like the concept of spin is very similar. I think that's a good analogy. We use a strange word to try to capture it. Spin is what the ball does when it goes through the air. So we have this idea of political spin, where you're trying to create an impression. The idea is not to present objectively the evidence to the audience. The idea is to sort of try to trick them in some way, manipulate them, that kind of idea.
In Othello, one of the things that's so sinister and mind-boggling about what Iago does to Othello is he could have just killed him, you know, if he didn't like him. He could have just, they were out on battlefields together. He could have arranged an accident any old time. But instead, you know, he kind of destroys him from within by making him question everything about his life and his wife.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the puzzles of interpretation of that play. Well, the question, why does he hate Othello to begin with? And nobody can really answer that question. It's not really very clear in the play about why he hates Othello. But if he does hate him, yes, he could kill him. But that's not what Iago is interested in. I think the reason Iago is not interested in it, Iago has a kind of pride in his own intellectual powers. And to assert his intellectual power over Othello is more important to him than just to stab him in the back. That's not his style. He enjoys a sense of having this control over Othello's mind. And that means that he's a superior person to Othello mentally. And I think that that is the main reason for it. I think a lot of people who are systematic liars have the same motivation. They realize that it takes them a certain amount of skill to do it, and they just enjoy outwitting other people and deceiving other people. And sometimes I think they do it for its own sake. They may not even particularly value the aim of the lie, but the very act and process of it, they get a kick out of that.
At the milder end of the spectrum, there are professions now in which people get paid large amounts of money to create more and more MFs. I'm thinking of advertising, of course. Do you think that there is more MFing now than there has been in the past?
I think there is more, and the reason really has to do with the growth of media. There's just more means for manipulating people. I think television has been one of the great MF inventions of all time. Advertising, of course, is, as you say, another case of it. Although advertising sometimes gets a bad rap. There's nothing wrong with telling people what products you have and sell it to them. It's just the means you use to do that. So, yeah, I think there's quite a bit more. I think the internet has really intensified it because people now reading many hours a day and looking at their screens, they're much more easily manipulated because there's no quality control in the kind of rhetoric that they're being fed. I think that, yeah, there's a lot of it going on. But on the other hand, the point I make in my book, because there's a multiplicity of voices, one voice can try to question another. So somebody comes up with something and say on the internet, some conspiracy theory, let's say, and another person come along and try to puncture that. Whereas I think in the old days when there was more of a monopoly on the means of persuasion, of course all totalitarian states want the monopoly of the media, then you don't have the opportunity for competition between different sources of information. So on the one hand, there's more because there's more media. On the other hand, it dilutes the effect because there's this competition.
Colin McGinn is a philosopher and the author of a book with a title we cannot say on the air, but which rhymes with mind trucking. If you have questions or comments about anything you heard, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can post a message on our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to know what you think. Coming up, more thinking about thinking. We'll introduce the advanced genius theory, and we meet the pioneering neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You know those artists who burst on the scene and everyone raves about how brilliant and original they are. And then a few years later, when they do something new, everyone says, oh, that's terrible. She must have been a one-book wonder. He's jumped the shark. Well, maybe we're the ones who just can't keep up with them. To the Best of Our Knowledge, producer Doug Gordon has found a new explanation. What have you learned?
Anne, I've learned about a new theory that may explain what's going on in these cases. It's called the advanced genius theory.
Okay, who came up with it?
A guy named Jason Hartley, along with his friend Britt Bergman. They were talking about the creative decline of Lou Reed over pizza at a Pizza Hut near the University of South Carolina. This was back in the early 90s. And during their conversation, they had an epiphany. Maybe Lou wasn't losing his creative edge. Maybe Lou was just ahead of Jason and Britt's time. And thus, the advanced genius theory was born. Jason Hartley explains the theory in his book, The Advanced Genius Theory. Are they out of their minds or ahead of their time?
There were established artists who were ahead of their time, and then everyone sort of caught up with them a little bit, and then they went off into directions that were really puzzling, especially to their initial fans. One of the great examples is Bob Dylan going electric. You know, he could have been a folk singer forever, and he would have had incredible credibility and would have been a legend as it was, but it wasn't enough for him. But going electric was, you know, heresy. He was called Judas by people in the audience. His biggest fans were the most hurt. And then that became sort of a theme, but then they would go to a place where then no one liked what they were doing. You look at Bob Dylan's output in the 80s, you know, just maligned completely. What we started to try to understand was, as we think about what taste is and what our judgment is about the quality of any artwork or anything in general, you know, it's very subjective. And when there's really no right answer, my take is I would rather take Bob Dylan's word for it than mine or some critic's or the public at large, because he's been right so many times before.
Lou Reed served as the inspiration for the advanced genius theory. What makes Lou Reed so advanced?
Wow, what doesn't make him so advanced? The famous statement that Brian Eno makes about the Velvet Underground, his first band, was that only 1,000 people bought the Velvet Underground records, but every single one of them started a band. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was influential, you can't question that. And he was completely innovative in what he did with the Velvet Underground and his earlier work. The subject matter of junkies and prostitutes and all that sort of thing, putting it into rock and roll was just not done yet. It was something that he created. He really created it, sort of a genre. So then as he evolved, then he started to do some of the things that the advanced do, which is when they're interviewed, they lie all the time. And I'm sure it's part of keeping up their mystery, but it's also a certain, you know, protecting themselves, I would imagine, and their artistic integrity. But then as he evolved, and then he got into the 70s, and he lived with a transvestite for a long time, and he dyed his hair blonde, and he made an album called Rock and Roll Animal, and all these things, you couldn't anticipate it going from where he was. And then as he evolved, then he went through the 80s and everyone hated his music, and then all of a sudden he was good again, and then he was bad again. Now he's doing albums with Metallica and getting his liver transplant recently. Yeah. One of the things that the advanced always do is they embrace technology. So I think getting a liver transplant is sort of like the apotheosis of embracing technology.
Is there one particular Lou Reed song that you think, Jason, makes the best case for Lou being an advanced genius?
Oh, wow. On the way over here, I was listening to Street Hassle, which is just an amazingly great song, but probably everything that makes him what he is in that. The cello and strings are sort of dominate the beginning, and he tells a story of junkies, and they're having sex, and they die, and it's really a very sad story, but it's also sort of callously told through different characters and that sort of thing.
Wasn't Matilda without her wallet? The sexy boy smiled in dismay. She took out 420s, cause she liked round figures. Everybody's green for a day. Oh, babe, I'm on fire, and you know I admire your body. Why don't we slip away? Although I'm sure you're certain it's a rarity, me flirting, sha la 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 this way. Oh, sha la 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 la, sha la 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 la, hey, baby. Come on, let's slip away.
He goes into sort of a fretless bass, which is an instrument that people really like. That's there, and there's guitar, and his voice is sort of flat and atonal, and there's this big, long story, and it's really challenging. It's 13 minutes of a song that you're supposed to sit and listen to, and it's really a sad song. But then he also got Bruce Springsteen to come in and do a little soliloquy, and that was sort of a takeoff on Born to Run, which is not something you would say, oh, well, Lou Reed's going to bring Bruce Springsteen in on this song.
Hey, man, that's just a lie. That's why she tells her friends. It's a real song that she won't even admit to herself. It's beating in her heart. It's a song lots of people know. It's a painful song. But it'll always say a truth. It'll last full of sad songs. A penny for a wish. A wish it won't make it, soldier. With a pretty kiss or a pretty face can't have its way. They're tramps like us. We were born to pay.
There's just so much in that song that makes it an amazing song, but also someone might hate it.
Do you have a favorite advanced genius from outside the world of music?
I think Orson Welles. I mean, that's the one that I always go back to because there's just so much about him. I mean, he achieved so much when he was young, and he's so universally seen as a failure. But if you read about him and what he was doing after, and there are canisters of film out there that I just would love to see put together. He was making a movie for years and years and years, and it was just sounds incredibly fascinating, and the people that he got involved. But then he was a pitch man for cheap wine.
Parmesan.
Exactly. You know, he was on The Muppets. My favorite thing about his appearance on The Muppets, though, is that he plays a movie producer, which is the exact person that destroyed his career, basically. Huh. You know, when he was doing Magnificent Ambersons, they tore up his film and they recut it as he was off in Mexico. You know, the fact that he would leave without it being edited, I have no understanding of that also. So, you know, that's just the advance for you. But I just love to read about some of the things. And Powers Booth told this story about performing with Orson Welles in a movie. And Orson Welles was supposed to be some character, and they said, well, he's in makeup. He has to get a prosthetic nose to be in character. He says he has to be in character. And Powers Booth said when he showed up, the prosthetic nose looked exactly like his regular nose. So go figure.
I can't help but notice, Jason, that we've only been talking about men. Are there any women that qualify as advanced geniuses?
I'm asked that frequently. My wife was one of the people who asked. Yeah. She's not advanced.
Or is she?
Well, you can't live with an advanced person. I mean, I think that's, you know. But at any rate, yeah, I think that there are women who are advanced. As I write in the book, it's my fault, really, that I haven't listened to more music by women. I am a man, and I probably lean that way just for whatever reason. But also the rules might be a little bit different. I deal mostly with rock and roll artists also, and people ask me about hip-hop and things like that. It's like, well, I don't know. The rules are a little different, you know. And for the musicians, the rock and roll musicians, they all wear black sunglasses. They all wear leather jackets. They sell out. They do all these things. But like for hip-hop, that's what you do when you're overt, so, you know, everything's crazy. But as far as women are concerned, I think that Madonna is a great possibility, but I don't know that she really embarrassed herself. She didn't really lose it. You know, one of the things that I say to people often is that women might just have better sense. And so it's not a bad thing that they're not advanced. And I'm certainly not saying that there aren't genius women artists. You know, I think Patti Smith is another woman who might have been an advanced artist in that she left music to go raise a family, which is about as unpunk rock as you could be. But then she came back, and she kind of came back into favor. But there is a great clip of her singing You Light Up My Life on a children's show on YouTube that I highly recommend you're checking out.
Okay, I will do that. What kind of reaction has the theory received?
Mostly positive. I would say that the people that, I have a Twitter account and Facebook. The thing that I hear most from people is they thank me for giving them sort of a tool to open their minds a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is if you start to think, well, maybe this is okay, and you know, start challenging what's okay and what's not, you just expand what you expose yourself to. And that can only be a good thing. Even if you don't like it, just experiencing it and maybe having a moment where it might have been okay or might have been a good thing just expands your world a little bit. There are people who get really upset when I tell them about the theory, or they've read it, and they say, you're crazy. Paul McCartney can't possibly be good anymore, and on and on and on. And then another day they'll come up to me and they'll say, well, is Peter Gabriel advanced? And then finally when they start to get it, it becomes something that it's not as challenging as it first appears.
Jason Hartley is the author of The Advanced Genius Theory. Are they out of their minds or ahead of their time? He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. You know, for centuries, philosophers have argued over and spun theories about how the mind works, but they never wasted that much time thinking about the brain, all that squishy stuff inside the skull. And that seems wrong to Patricia Churchland. She's a pioneering neurophilosopher and the author of the book Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. And it was when she was teaching at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg that she first realized that she needed to learn more about the human brain. As she tells Steve Paulson,
I went down to the medical school and talked to the anatomists, the neuroanatomists, and said, you know, I really feel that I want to understand the brain to the degree that we do understand it so that I can approach questions about the mind, about how we reason or remember, why we sleep and dream, what it is to be conscious. But I know I need to understand the brain. And that was kind of the beginning of this long journey that was so wonderful and so exciting and such fun.
And I'm guessing that was pretty unusual for a philosopher to go to the medical school wanting to learn about neuroanatomy. Probably not too many other philosophers were interested in the science of the brain.
No, it's quite true. It was rather unusual, and I think it was fortunate that I was at Winnipeg, where people were used to lots of eccentricity and didn't think it was a terrible thing for me to do. On the other hand, within the profession of philosophy, many people, I think, thought I was just nuts. and that if you want to understand the mind, you don't need to know anything about the brain. Part of the reason they said this, and this was really a very strong idea, was that the mind is like the software and the brain is like the hardware. And just as if you want to understand what's wrong with your word processing application, you pay attention not to the nuts and bolts of the machine, but to the software. So you don't need to know anything about the brain in order to understand the mind.
Mm. Well, it strikes me that there has been just a huge sea change since then. I mean, hardly any serious scholars, including philosophers, would say that you can really talk about the mind without at least making reference to the brain. I mean, you sort of can't separate the mind from the brain.
It's pretty hard now, I think. It was easier 25 years ago. But it's very difficult now to say that because there are such tight correlations between changes in the brain and changes in psychological states, such as remembering or making a decision. And I think that the first bit of neuroscience that really blew this all wide open were the split brain results, where patients with intractable epilepsy underwent a surgery whereby the two hemispheres of the brain were separated. And the astonishing thing was that there was what's called a disconnection syndrome, and that is one hemisphere might have access to information that the other didn't, and that that had an effect on behavior. Given that, it was very hard for anybody to say, you know, well, there's really a soul in there, you know, a ghosty thing in there that somehow has also become disconnected. And I think the split brain results were tremendously important. And then many, many other things followed on after that.
Well, you have gone on to pioneer this relatively new field that has been called neurophilosophy. But I'm wondering if you could do it over again, would you have become a neuroscientist instead of a philosopher?
You know, it's always hard to imagine yourself back because what exactly do you imagine? That it was the same situation as when you were actually there? Or if I were, say, 21 now, would I go into neuroscience? I think the answer is probably if I were 21 now, I would go into neuroscience, as both my children actually have. Hmm. And I think neuroscience, of course, is a huge field with many levels at which people study nervous systems. So there's many, many questions that people can address and make progress on. And I think that the really sharp people in psychology, philosophy, biology are going into neuroscience because it's so exciting. It's the new frontier.
Well, it raises the question of whether philosophy has anything to add to the study of the mind or the brain, or is all the action really in science, in neuroscience?
Well, of course, philosophy covers many things beyond philosophy of mind. And so there are people who think a lot about the history of philosophy, including Asians such as Confucius and Mencius, as well as the Greeks like Aristotle and Plato. So there's certainly something to be done there. But within the domain of philosophy of mind, my view is that if you really want to make progress, then you need to pay attention to the science. Now, the science might be quite high level and might involve mostly behavior, or it might be very low level and involve molecules that have to do with how information is stored and retrieved. But if you think that you can answer questions, for example, about the nature of decision making, without knowing anything about the psychology and the neurobiology of decision-making, you're probably deluding yourself.
Now, another issue that you explore is this classic philosophical problem. Do we have free will?
Aha. Uh-huh.
As you point out, a lot rides on how we define free will. How do you define it?
Well, I like to think of decision-making, which is really the ambit of free will, I like to think of decision-making as involving varying kinds of control. So some, you might think of this as a very simple case of a decision, but from the point of view of the brain, a decision is, for example, a reflex. You make a noise over to my right, my eyes turn and my head turns automatically. On the other hand, of course, I could control that. So if I know that you are up to no good and you want me to turn my head, I can steadfastly look away and the direction I'm currently looking. So there are levels and levels and levels of control. And we know that control can be compromised by many things. If I'm very tired and very hungry, my control is apt to be poorer than if I'm rested and fully satisfied. And we also know that control can be compromised by certain drugs like heroin or cannabis or alcohol and so forth. So I think it's important to put the whole idea of free will in the context of control and the mechanisms for control. Now, the sad fact is, of course, that at this stage of neuroscience, there's so much about the details of the mechanisms for control that we don't really understand.
I think the way this translates to most people is, given two choices in front of us, can we choose one or the other? Or is there something inside of us that is sort of pushing us to make that decision for us? I mean, I don't know, at the unconscious level or something like that. I mean, do we actually have free will to make that choice?
Well, if you think by we, the we here, let's just use a different pronoun. Let's say the I here. I am a product of my brain. There is no difference between the me that I am and the brain that I have. So my sense of self and my sense of being an agent who can do things is all something that emerges from the way the brain organizes itself to efficiently behave and get itself around the planet. So when you say, is there something causing me to do this behavior? I want to say, well, the brain is a causal machine, so causal effects are in place, of course, but that doesn't mean that there is no difference between someone who, say, has obsessive compulsive disorder and someone who doesn't. I wash my hands because they're dirty, because I don't have obsessive compulsive disorder. So the way to think about it is not that are we free from all causes, but rather, which are the causes that allow us to be held responsible for what we do and to do what we plan and we organize and what's in our interest to do? Are there differences between those causes and the causes that where we say, I wish I didn't have to go back and check the stove, but I just have to? And the answer is yes. There are differences, and we're beginning to understand the nature of those differences, and they involve relations between frontal cortex and subcortical structures.
Patricia Churchland is the author of Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. She talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamp, sitting in for Jim Fleming. You can listen to more of To the Best of Our Knowledge and find a link to the weekly podcast on our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program What We Think About When We Think About Thinking. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by thoughtful people at Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon masterminded this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Sarah Nix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.